3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nations, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders, past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
Because the land to us is the whole thing, right? The land is an ecosystem. It's not real estate.
Blockading is symbolic, but it's also literal, because what you're saying is whatever's being done, it stops here. And it's deadly serious because you're laying your body on the line.
Welcome to Tree Sits, Lock-Ons and Barricades, a program about the history of environmental blockading in the 1980s and 1990s. During those decades, Australian, Canadian and American activists took part in a series of environmental blockades that didn't just defend old-growth forests, rivers and other biodiverse places, but also changed the way we understood and valued them. From occupying trees high up in the redwoods of the Pacific Northwest to facing down bulldozers in northern New South Wales and British Columbia, these activists also created a tactical toolkit that has served communities ever since. My name is Ian McIntyre, and you're listening to Community Radio 3CR. In place of on-screen from December 22nd to January 19, I'm presenting a series of conversations with activists who took part in these pioneering campaigns. Today's conversation is with Karen Coulter, who co-founded the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project in 1991 and who currently serves as its director. The group maintains a watch over old-growth forests in eastern Oregon and campaigns against their destruction. Karen is also a long-term member of Earth First and took part in many of its blockades during the 1980s and 1990s. Earth First is a radical environmental network that first emerged in the United States during 1980. Earth First adopted a non-hierarchical organizing style and a focus on direct action tactics to pursue a no-compromise position in opposing the logging, mining and development of old-growth forests and other biodiverse places. By the 1990s, Earth First had grown to include around 100 groups in the US with chapters in the UK, Australia, the Netherlands and other countries, and the network remains active today. In the following interview, Karen discusses her experiences within Earth First, both as an active participant and as a non-violence trainer. She starts out by discussing how she first got involved with the network, as well as where it was taking its cues from when it first started doing blockades in the 1980s.
Well, I was working against the MX missile in Nevada in 1980, and I got the very first thing I think they ever put out, which was a two-page, typewritten, two-sided piece about why they formed and their principles, like no compromise in defense of Mother Earth. And they had a little bit of a membership form on the back, which is highly amusing because they've never had members. I remember reading it and being very excited about it because I'd been getting signatures for protection of the rare two. It's called Roadless Area mm-hmm. Review and Evaluation that was being done for the Pacific Northwest. And I was getting signatures to protect all those roadless areas on the streets of Portland. And then later I found out that the big mainstream environmental groups sold us out for only about 15% of them. And we've been fighting to protect those ever since. And so at any rate, I was pretty pissed at the big mainstream organizations and was immediately interested. And even though I was only 68 miles from where they were based, I just kept in Nevada, seeing the roadshow posters after the roadshow had been. And then in 1984, I hooked up with George Callies, who was canvas director with Greenpeace in Portland. He knew about Earth First, and at that point there was only one contact person for Earth First in Portland, Oregon. And we almost immediately did a banner hang with Roselle about protecting old-growth forests from, I don't know, maybe the third or fourth floor of the Forest Service Region 6 building in Portland. And so that's how I first got involved. Yeah, I started out with the nuclear freeze and nuclear weapons movement and did my first actions with them. It's part of something called Northwest Action for Disarmament in Portland, Oregon in 1984. and was involved with a series of direct actions around Portland with them. And 1984 was also the first year I did direct action with Earth First in the same place. And they were a great affinity group structure. And I became a nonviolence trainer. A lot of the founders of Earth First had no direct action experience at all, no nonviolence training or anything. So I think to consider the long history of nonviolent civil disobedience in the U.S., the civil rights movement, the women's suffrage movement, the anti-Vietnam movement, anti-war movement. So I think probably that was the model that everybody had kind of ingrained in them. Those are taught in school. So you find out about it and see information about it for a long time. I don't think there was any other real overt model in the early days. It definitely started out as more of a macho movement. And over time, various activists, especially women, changed that. And as the activist culture changed in general, late 1990s or early 2000s, there was the Straw Devil tree sit in Western Oregon, and there was actually a trans and women's sail unit tree sit where only trans people and women came. And so that marked definitely a turning point. So by that point, it had definitely changed the culture. But I do remember the early macho days where I came roaring up in a pickup truck and was wearing a big hat to look macho even. I mean, I drive a pickup truck anyway, but I remember there was a photograph of me in some early Earth First rendezvous nursing my baby at the fire with a big Western hat on.
Up until 1990, the scale and length of most actions in the U.S. were initially shorter compared to those in Australia and Canada, where people would often camp out in the forest and blockade for sort of weeks, if not months on end. Why do you think in the U.S. these initial actions during the 80s were sort of much more shorter and more intermittent?
It had a lot to do with whether the site was near a supportive population center or not. And there was also very quick law enforcement, quite often ending it when it was near a population center. And quite often there were not enough people who could risk arrest and so forth. There was a big diversity of levels of prior experience, and I don't remember anybody arguing for it to be a certain way based on their experience with other movements or anything of the sort. So I think it varied a lot, and I think it started moving towards longer-term blockades later in the 90s. I think at first it was very much like, okay, let's just sit down and block this, like the 1983 Bald Mountain blockade, for instance. And over time into the 90s, it became more technical lockdowns as people developed ways of making the blockade last longer and stopping the work longer. And I think that was the early emphasis, is stopping the progress of the destruction. Later, it became more media-focused as other activists got involved who had a lot of other experience, such as Judy Berry and others, and as we developed the tree sitting, because tree sitting was very much a media attention getter.
So things seem to have picked up a lot more in the 1990s. Could you tell us about that, as well as the sort of splits and changes that were happening in Earth First at this time?
Yeah, there was a lot happening in the 1990s in this country with Earth First. Most of the actions I remember are from then. We were more of the anarchists and activists who had broader activist experience, and we thought you couldn't end the problems just by focusing on wilderness and roadless areas, although that's very important, but that we had to start focusing on things like climate change, destroying the forest, social inequities and indigenous struggles and all kinds of things, being more holistic in our approach. And so that had a lot to do with the split. And the other thing that had a lot to do with the split in 1989 was that the Dave Foreman and his wife, Nancy Morton in particular, were using the U.S. flag as a symbol for the rendezvous at the rendezvous. And this was very problematic to the rest of us because we had a broader concept of the flag, and basically we thought it would be appropriate for blood to be dripping off the red lines because it represents genocide and wars across the world. And so that's what really precipitated the split, but there were a lot of conflicts brewing before that point.
In general, Earth Firsters had differing opinions regarding what constituted violence and whether property destruction was a useful tactic. However, within blockades, a non-violent direct action code was generally adopted in which participants agreed to avoid harming others, acting aggressively or carrying weapons. Why do you think Earth First has adopted this approach, and can you tell us about your experience of facilitating non-violence training workshops?
In the early 80s, I don't remember how it was exactly, except there was a general agreement to be non-violent. But then later we did start defining, okay, ecological sabotage, if you don't hurt any living thing, that was generally agreed to be non-violent. I was more on the more practical side. I once went to a nonviolent training presentation, which was exceedingly boring, about the ideology. It had me wanting to go to sleep. It wasn't that long. When I worked with the nuclear, anti-nuclear movement, the trainings could be as long as a day, or some might have been more than a day. When I became involved with Earth First, I was as ready as anybody else not to have it last a day. The longest I ever did was 8 hours myself. We had one fabulous six-hour one where we brought 650 people to consensus in the nuclear movement, and that I was one of the facilitators in that. And then with Earth First, quite often you just don't have that much time. So with Earth First, I would usually do anywhere from, say, a two-and-a-half to three-hour training to the fastest one I ever did was, I think it was during Redwood Summer, and it was 45 minutes because that's all I had. And so mine are based not so much on ideological nonviolence as looking at ethical and practical reasons, both sides, for doing nonviolence initially, and then going into alternating role plays and presentations. Like Santi and I developed this one together, this standard nonviolence training together. And what was different about ours is we based it on our stories. So much experience with different actions and different settings and different situations that almost everything we taught people had a story attached to it, and people really liked it because it was just more interesting. Funny stories and tragic stories and scary stories and everything. And then we did a lot of the traditional role plays, like the hassle line, sometimes an oppression line. I once did a nonviolence graph where people sat down and actually graphed what's considered not nonviolent and what isn't, but I didn't do that with Earth First usually. Mm-hmm. And then I usually did an affinity group role play where I'd have people count off like four groups or however many there were. It varied a lot how many people were involved. Mm. And I'd have the first group be an affinity group, like it was no more than, say, four to eight people. Sit down, and everybody else surround them in a circle, and I would give them a scenario, and I'd walk away and confer with somebody who was going to be a plant, and or a couple somebodies, like good cop, bad cop, or angry logger, or whatever. Mm. And we would give them, say, a minute to make their consensus decision as they were being interrupted by the cop or whoever. And everybody would watch and see how well they performed in terms of picking a facilitator, using consensus, making sure everybody was heard, prioritizing what needed to be decided first and leaving the rest for later, and so forth, because it was always an urgent situation. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, we'd have critique and compliments, whatever they were, from the bystanders, and then critique and concerns and whatever came up from the people engaged. And then we'd have the next group sit down, and this time it would be 30 seconds. And then the next group, 15 seconds, you know, and so forth, because that's real-life situation. I mean, quite often you're threatened with a felony, and they'll walk away and just give you a minute or so to decide. You'll think you have lots of time on something, and then angry loggers walk up and tell you they're about to go pick up reinforcements and drive back, and it won't take them long, and so forth. So that was a way of actually practicing consensus decision-making in emergency direct action. And then I would go into the legal process and where the decision points are from the action arrest point, what you say to an officer, and all the way down to a jury trial or a bench trial, and all the different split-offs of different options along the way. But earlier on, I'd do the hassle line. One side would be cops or loggers or whoever, and the other side would be the protesters, and then we'd switch sides, and again, we'd critique how it went. among the participants as well as among the observers who were training. There, of course, were a lot of different variations at different times, but generally with Earth First, it got shorter and more practical, and talking about both ethical and pragmatic reasons for nonviolence. Because I think if I'd been born in, say, Guatemala during the dictatorship or in Nicaragua during when the Sandinistas were fighting, I might have gone to the mountains and become a guerrilla. Who knows? I mean, it's very situational. It just, but from a pragmatic standpoint, it doesn't make any sense, from my perspective, in the U.S. to pick up arms. I mean, that's a good way to get quashed and not build a movement. You have to change value systems and work in different ways.
Were most of the blockades reacting to immediate threats, or were they also part of a longer-term strategies and larger campaigns?
At the time, it was much more reactive. I saw it as, in retrospect, I see it as having made certain concepts into household words and popularizing them, such as old growth. And I think we now need to do that for biodiversity. Occasionally, when there was direct action combined with more mainstream campaign, those were more successful when there were many other strategies going on at the same time. But I think we lost a lot of the actual places we were fighting for just with direct action. We did stop Bald Mountain Road. I didn't in particular. Yeah. And then later on, Warner Creek and in Seattle, 1989, 1990, we stopped the logging of the Cedar River watershed and the Green River watershed through a huge campaign, which involved mainstream tactics as well as a very strategic direct action plan. And that was through the Cedar River Action Group, which really was started by Earth Firsters, Asante, me, and a few others. But we incorporated a lot of new people in Seattle to try to get the profile back up on old growth. And we purposely picked the logging in the drinking watershed because we discovered that Seattle people really cared about the source of their water. And we also discovered that they were clear-cutting the drinking watershed, but they wouldn't allow you to hike in it for fear you might spill a little sediment. Through staged direct actions, which we were at liberty to focus on totally because part of the group split off once we were heavily infiltrated to do nothing but legal stuff like benefits, petitioning the city council to buy the land from the Forest Service, doing pickets outside the city council, letters to the editor. It was front page news of the Seattle papers for quite a while, like a year or so, pretty constantly. And then meanwhile, we were planning as a separate affinity group so we wouldn't be infiltrated how to do the direct actions. The first one was a tree sit to show how beautiful it was on the edge so the media could see where we were on the edge of the forest, so that was media influence. Then the second one was a month or so later was to show who was responsible for so a lockdown at the Forest Service. And then the third one was actually blocking the logging from happening. There were 18 of us, and we were blocking the felling of trees by scattering where they would fall them by two loggers, and they left at about 3 o'clock. And by that point, the forest was closed, and so we had given primetime reporter exclusive coverage if he came in with us in the middle of the night, and so he came in and documented all this, and then we were waited a while to make sure the loggers weren't coming back, but we let him go with a couple people, and he was immediately arrested on his way out. So we got primetime coverage for a week or more, which helped stop it. By the time we couldn't get into the forest anymore because they tripwired it and had attack dogs and things like that, we'd already won it, pretty much. And now there's another group that's monitoring that and making sure that those drinking water sheds are still protected from logging. So that was a huge success, and that was a good example of a very integrated campaign with lots of strategies going on. And then in the 90s, I think we got more integrated to some extent, but I still remember in the 90s my frustration with not enough.
The sun is hot, the earth is dry. I sit here praying for water from the sky. I can almost feel coming. I can almost hear those raindrops humming. Oh, let it rain. Won't you let it rain? Oh, let it rain. Lord, won't you let it rain?
Listening to Community Radio 3CR, and welcome back to Tree Sits, Lock-Ons and Barricades, a program about the history of environmental blockading during the 1980s and 1990s. Just then we heard a track from Alice DiMicello called Let It Rain, which was from her debut album in 1988, and she's a musician who's long been associated with Earth First and other environmental causes. My name's Ian McIntyre, and today I'm chatting with Karen Coulter, the director of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, about her experiences with Earth First during the 1980s and 1990s. We pick up the conversation where Karen's talking about the differences between California, Oregon, and Washington at the time, as well as how the forcing of the Federal Wildlife Service to protect spotted owl habitat shifted things in the second half of the 1980s.
California was a very different situation than Oregon and Washington in a lot of ways. For instance, Judy Berry came from labor organizing experience, and they were dealing with a very favorable terrain of a very liberal state with a lot of college campuses to recruit from. So they did a lot of outreach and recruitment from college campuses in a way that we really didn't do and really couldn't do to a large extent. Compared to there,
yeah.
Oregon and Washington were very reliant on logging traditionally. And around the same time as the spotted owl controversy, late 80s, early 90s, and 1990, loggers were really feeling the loss of jobs and mill closures because of the automation of the industry, but the industry, timber industry, blamed it on the spotted owl very conveniently and on activists. So they turned the violent impulses of the angry loggers towards us when it was very clearly a matter of automation and exporting of raw logs and downsizing of employees. 1989 was the peak timber harvest, so to speak, in Oregon at 8.9 billion board feet and has never been surpassed since, and that was before the spotted owl got listed. So, and there was lots and lots of logging then, obviously. So their anger was very profound around that time because they, even though it was the peak timber harvest, there were less people employed, which means it was the timber industry, automation, and so forth. It's still pretty prickly out where I live, where I'm sitting right now in Eastern Oregon, but the collaborative process that came in with the Bush administration, or the Forest Service, to use a law that streamlined the public process, had to use a collaborative process involving local people and environmentalists and loggers and ranchers and so forth, actually took away some of the polarization because they met us face to face.
An Earth First Nomadic Action Group, loosely based on the Australian group of the time, was formed in the mid-1980s. What role did they and other travelling activists play in environmental campaigning?
I do remember the Nomadic Action Group actually being a physical body of people who traveled around for a while. They were initiating, not advising, but later in the 90s, a lot of movement of Earth Firsters around the country happened to help with critical campaigns, like the Minnehaha campaign, was that Minnesota, and earlier with the Cove Mallard campaign and with Redwood Summer, and I think that became a much more set pattern of people traveling to a destination and helping with campaigns, not so much to advise as to participate and support, but because we have such an open consensus process, people could definitely give ideas based on their experience. And I think that the Earth First movement in general has sort of a social status ranking based on people's experience, where whoever was local tended to be deferred to in organizing particular local campaigns, and people would follow along. But if there were open meetings, which there usually were, then people could contribute ideas for how to do things.
Beyond direct contact, how are Earth Firsters sharing ideas about tactics and strategies?
Definitely from the Earth First Journal. And then in the 90s, there were more zines passed around at rendezvous and workshops, and there were a lot more activist trainings. But I think it wasn't from mainstream media that people picked up these ideas. Very few of us really paid much attention to mainstream media except to watch our film direct action coverage. And so it was much more word of mouth and movement culture, living with each other in group houses, meetings, rendezvous, and also workshops and road shows were very key. Roadshows were very key to publicizing the Earth First movement and growing it early on. And the roadshows still happen to some extent. Right now there's, although not as much as they used to be relied on, but right now there's Earth First the Musical. I did an interview with somebody to give some history on that. I heard it's pretty good. There's some things older Earth Firsters might not agree with, but in general it's interesting. We did some road shows just to advertise rendezvous, and we went up and down the coast from Arcata, California, to all the way up to Bellingham, Washington, with stops all along the way. And so we were consciously trying to imitate the old roadshow model, which was so fundamental to growing the movement, basically.
What are your memories of some of the early tree sits, and what sort of role have they come to play within blockades and radical environmentalism?
I think a lot of it is really to get media attention, but occasionally it's more than that. Julia Butterfly is a good example of it being more than that, although it's a big publicity vehicle, that tree sit, all over the world. But if you find out what she ended up saving, it's rather pathetic. It was a few trees in a logged area. I mean, the area got logged, and they just saved some big old trees in the middle of the heavy logging. So I think most of the time, those individual trees do get cut down, but it might not be about the individual trees. And then in Eastern Oregon out here, there's a tree sit anywhere away from Bend, Oregon, would be laughable. because the Bend, Oregon, it would be done for media purposes. Mm-hmm. But everything else out here is so rural, and there's so much access. It's so flat. There's so many roads. It's just,
right.
It would be such a tiny part of any given timber sales that they would just log all around it, which, of course, they have done in some cases. However, on the west side of Oregon, a lot of the sales used to be only about, and still are, actually, some of them, 47 to 200 acres. And there are trees that can be more effective because you can rope into other trees and you have a more supportive local populace and you have more media that will actually come out to it because it's close. Yeah, and if you look at the history of tree sitting out here, there's hardly been, we haven't had any that I'm aware of in eastern Oregon, and probably none in Idaho and Montana, as far as I know, for the same reasons as eastern Oregon. Rural, no supportive public, nearby, no media nearby, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a definite reason why a lot of us older Earth Firsters, when we decided consciously, which we did, to move away from the West Side Corridor, and to disperse in rural areas and put our roots down and just start protecting where we lived, which is what I'm doing in eastern Oregon and what Friends of the Clearwater, also started by Earth Firsters, is doing in Idaho. And there's been groups started by Earth Firsters in Montana and in eastern Washington. We rapidly discovered that direct action, except for a few exceptions, didn't really work. And so that's why I turned to legal forest defense. And it's kind of ironic because usually you think of people going through the legal system, discovering that it's rigged, and then turning to direct action. But we actually did the opposite because we moved from being near cities and the movement en masse to being in very isolated rural areas that were extremely hostile, and that quite often it would be very hard to stop things through direct action, although the big exception in Idaho is, of course, Cove Mallard. But that wasn't so much tree sits. That was blockades. And that brought in people from all over the place. It wasn't just local Idaho people. But local people in these rural areas have faced kind of the same situation I have, and so we've turned to following the public process and using litigation to try to stop things. And arguably, I've stopped a hell of a lot more directly on the ground through litigation and public process than I ever did with direct action. But I still think that direct action is really needed to up the ante and get more people into a movement and show more public opposition. And I'm really feeling the loss of that right now.
Can you tell us about how you responded to the Clinton government's 1995 salvage rider? This law essentially allowed timber companies to override environmental protections.
I came from more of the point of view that direct action would be pretty impossible here. We tried it once and we were shut down after one day, and I was on the phone all day trying to get reinforcements from other states and from Oregon, and no success at all, no media. And so by the end of the day, our paltry 13 people, three of them kids, left because they were outnumbered by 5-1 by law enforcement. And that was a rare circumstance where it was a roadless area post-fire logging during the salvage rider, which was known as logging without laws in 95 or 96. So there were only two main roads leading in, so we blocked one of them with an overturned truck and a tripod with a 14-year-old Earth Firster on top and another Earth First woman locked by the neck to the undercarriage of the truck, and then the larger men deployed below and a barricade below that. And it was good we did all that because by the time they got up to where, because we put the barricade way down the hill, so by the time they got to us, they were kind of tired. So they just left. That was our one attempt, but that was when the laws stopped being functional. But we still saved a lot through lobbying through somebody we knew in NRDC of the Interior Secretary, Dan Glickman. So we actually didn't have most of our roadless areas logged at that time, which a lot of other people did.
The Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project and other similar groups started by Earth Firsters have often used lobbying and litigation as their main tools, but you've employed these in quite different ways to mainstream environmental organizations. Could you expand on how you do things differently?
The bigger mainstream groups were not very radical or aggressive in their litigation, and I think the groups like mine and Friends of the Clearwater and others that were started by Earth Firsters came with the biocentric ethic and a concept of deep ecology and a more radical stance in general. And also we spend more time in the forest so we're pretty grounded and have a sense of place and get more passionate because we spend time out there and we believe in Big Wild and don't just look at the documents, which is what the mainstream groups do, and don't believe in the system, which a lot of the mainstream groups do. And so we have been much more successful with our litigation because we're more willing to take big risks when it makes any sense legally. But I think that it was much more, we had such an uproar about logging, such a huge public movement about it, and I think now it's been co-opted a lot, at least out here, by us not controlling the narrative, because now a lot of people believe that logging is restoration. A lot of people still don't know that outside of the local areas that logging is even happening, and I think there's a lot of federal control over the narrative where they say logging is restoration. Watch out for the evil fire. We're trying to reduce fire risk. Insects and disease are terrible scourge on the forest. We're trying to improve forest health. And they've been saying this for decades, but now they're having more traction with local people because partly there's been a huge economic recession and mills have been closing down again and a lot of economic desperation out here and there's just enough environmental awareness that now loggers want to believe they're doing something right for the environment. So every single timber sale out here is called a restoration project or a vegetation management. They're not called timber sales anymore, but they're just as much timber sales as ever. And the restoration is like window dressing. It's very small. So I think that's a huge problem in the U.S. The climate movement is really going hard here, and so is the movement against fossil fuels, energy extraction. And so, to some extent, Earth First and a lot of other groups have diverted their attention to that, and arguably climate change is the most profound and serious crisis globally of our time. But forests are connected with that. So what we're trying to do lately is trying to get the climate change movement to recognize the role of keeping forests standing in that.
Wake up, won't you wake up? Can you wake up? This treadmill running on our steam. This treadmill is a big machine. This treadmill running on our sweat. It's making this place good as dead. So come on, I want you wake up. Won't you, won't you, won't you?
You're listening to Treesit's Lock-Ons and Barricades on Community Radio 3CR. You just heard a song from Joanne Rand, an Earth First musician of the 1980s and 1990s, called Wake Up, which came from a 1992 live album. My name's Ian McIntyre, and today I'm chatting with Karen Coulter, director of the Blue Mountains Biodiversity Project, about Earth First blockades. We pick up the conversation at a point where I asked her about the tactics Earth Firsters were using in the 1980s.
The early blockades in the Earth First movement in the 80s were all soft blockades. And so it was more towards the 90s that there started to be lockdowns. Then they got more and more elaborate. So in 95-ish, during the salvage logging rider, Warner Creek, that was what's called a sleeping dragon blockade, mm-hmm. where my friend Mick put his arm through solid big metal door that he got from a bar that had changed from a car garage in Eugene, and into a cement-lined hole and locked down with his hand with a lock at the very bottom of the hole, lying on his side across that road. And then there was also the black bears, where instead of just straight metal tubes that people would lock their arms through to some piece of equipment in order for the police not to be, or law enforcement not to be able to saw through the lock because it was encased in heavy metal or in something else wrapped with wire, like almost like a plaster cast or hard plastic. They started creating curved ones so that they could curve around things. And then they also used out here in various parts of the country either big barrels filled with concrete with holes bored through with a pin that you could lock your arm to, lock your hand or your wrist to. And the reason for the barrels was to more effectively block a road with fewer people. The barrels took up space, and you could have your arms out and still be hard to dismantle. And I also have a slide in my Earth First History presentation of them using big, round, old growth, what used to be stumps or round, to lock into as well. So there was a lot of innovation, especially in the 90s and maybe the late 80s. Warner Creek in 95 or so not only had the sleeping dragon and a gate lockdown, a gate closure lockdown, but it also set up a whole teepee village, lasted through the whole winter through heavy snow, and had what were called the road peckers digging deep trenches through the roads that were impassable all the way through all the foundational rocks and heavy old growth logs under the road and everything all the way down, and also set up rock blockades and slash and so forth and so on. And we also did a lot of that at the Cove Mallard. During the Cove Mallard rendezvous, people did that to block the Jack Road. About 100 people or so stayed up all night by torchlight, creating all these elaborate blockades on the Jack Road that was accessing the Cove Mallard sales in Idaho. And so the blockades were very elaborate because you could have, say, 20 people go up a slope and move a heavy old-growth log to block the road, and there were huge metal culverts, enormous metal culverts that people found somewhere and used to block the road, and then blockades of many, many, many lodgepole pines that were already dead, that were just pulled out of the forest and used as a sort of confrontational thing. And so I don't know how many blockades there were, but an awful lot. These things slowed it down. When the Warner Creek blockade was finally dismantled, it was dismantled very quickly, but it took a long time for it to get to that point, pretty much won by that point. So all the logging was stopped back there, as I remember it.
Were there many connections with Canadian activists through the 1980s and 1990s?
Canada was very influential, and still is, actually, on Earth First in the U.S. I mean, the Earth First Journal still covers a lot of hardcore, especially indigenous people's actions up there, and there was a big flooding of Earth First activists and primarily Earth First from the U.S. to Bella Coola for a long indigenous people's campaign to save this area that had a lot of water, and then also a lot of awareness about the Great Bear Rainforest and many other Canadian issues. So I think there's been a lot of crossover in terms of people coming up and going down to various actions. Yeah, and also there's a very significant difference between Indigenous struggles in the U.S. and Indigenous struggles in Canada, because in Canada, at least in BC, and I think elsewhere, they never, the Native nations never relinquished their rights. There weren't treaties abrogating their rights and their territory in particular. Whereas here, they may have treaty rights, such as the Umatilla near me, regarding hunting and fishing and cultural site use and cultural plant gathering and so forth, ceremonies and so forth. But they don't have full control of their territory anymore. They have a reservation, but they don't have their original territory, whereas a lot of the indigenous people in BC can go back out onto their territory and live off it.
What were some of the other actions that you were personally involved in during the 1980s?
In 1984, there was a protest, Earth First protest I was involved with, I think in the middle of Santa Am, and one of our photographers was arrested for failing to assist the police in arresting other people, defended himself on that and won, which was a good precedent. And one of the other people did help arrest us, which was really revolting. And then there were also the Brighton Bush actions, logging near this resort. And there's the 1987 Silver Fire actions. I was part of that. There was a lockdown in Grants Pass and huge rallies and things like that. And Santi and I did our own little road tour. We went down to the Southwest with 2 6-year-olds in a Subaru car with a teepee lashed to the top and spent 6 months roving around doing Earth First actions in various states. 1989 at the first Earth First Organizers Conference where I got arrested on felony charges, which was odd. I got dropped, but for doing a public demonstration at the American Express office against development in the San Juan Mountains, where there are grizzly and wolves and lynx. And we did stop that ski resort development there, partly through a boycott of American Express that we launched after being in prison or in jail in a very aggressive town. So I spent 5 days in jail, and the irony of this, there were several ironies, but one of the ironies is they had a public payphone in the jail cell, and I used it to do media calls. And I got to know my local inmates. I mean, we were all, they watched what we did on the news and thought we were heroes or heroines, and we gave them our meat because we were vegetarians, which made us popular, and I did drawings for the other prisoners, which made me popular. And then on that tour, we also supported with a public demonstration Manuel Lujan, the Secretary of the Interior at the time, who was much hated by Earth Firsters for various reasons, was speaking at a hotel in Tucson, Arizona, and a woman dressed up like somebody you'd expect to be at a fancy hotel and went in and dropped a vial of smells really horrible, I guess, in the buffet area. And we were protesting outside as she did this, and it was really funny watching the news later because they evacuated 9 stories of that hotel. And one guy came out saying it smelled like a combination of vomit and dog shit. And then we were doing this little roving poetry, music, skit roadshow for Earth First throughout the Southwest and had various stops. We just decided to do it. And then I also was part of a hunt sabotage in the Mojave around that time, too. That must have been around 1989, 1990 also. There was a bighorn sheep hunt. Wealthy, wealthy hunters who spent $60,000 for a bighorn sheep. And they were led by guides who, and they had really fancy scope rifles to shoot at a distance, and we were trying to disrupt the hunt. It was basically an Earth First / animal rights effort by blowing air horns when we got anywhere near the bighorn sheep, and we weren't successful because the Fish and Wildlife Service, or I guess it was called, we called it the Department of Squish and Maim, would see where we were headed every morning very early.
And what about the Brighton Bush blockades of the 1980s?
Basically, the logging came to them. They were sort of a back-to-the-land, let's-make-a-go-of-this-resort-for-money kind of community, a collective community. And the logging came to them, but there were very dramatic direct actions involved, like I think it was Leo Hund, who buried himself up to the neck in the road, middle of the road with just his head sticking out. They saved a lot. They saved roadless areas and a lot of forest around there that's extremely beautiful. And there's northern spotted owls around there still.
Could you tell us about Redwood Summer in 1990 and some of the actions in the years that followed?
Redwood Summer definitely marked a turning point. However, there's all those caveats about organizing in California and around Redwoods. Redwoods mm-hmm. were extremely popular for good reason. And they got celebrities involved. There's lots of wealthy people in California and a lot of animal rights people and a lot of people who are into the environment. So a lot of Northern California campaigns were very well funded by, I suspect, individual donors, also because of pot growing having gone on mm-hmm. a long time there and funding activists in Washington, Oregon, and everywhere who go down to make money there. So there's a lot of caveats as to why it took off, not just Redwood Summer, but the whole campaigns around Headwaters and Redwoods. They would have rallies with what I've heard were up to 20,000 people. And people like Bonnie Raitt got arrested and Woody Harrelson on the Golden Gate Bridge, so forth. So although it marked a turning point for that kind of organizing and mass movement, it's not like we could pull that off everywhere. A lull just in Washington and Oregon because a lot of the sales got canceled with the Spotted Owl decision and there were injunctions against a lot of the timber sales. But that soon changed. There was a huge compromise under Clinton and with Option 9 of mm-hmm. the Northwest Forest Plan. So after that, then there was a lot of litigation, and then there was a lot of real upsurge of direct action activism with the Salvage Rider, including Warner Creek, Hobson, Sugarloaf, Enola Hill, and many, many other tree sits and blockades in the 1990s.
Our grandparents were born here. Ancestors lived with this earth. The land is the people, and the people are the land, and this is the land of our birth. But now you want to move us off this mesa, as if you can take a body from a soul. You wanna take from us our paradise on earth and trade it for a mountain of coal. What if they were coming for your grandma? What if they were coming for your child? What if they were tearing up the ground beneath your feet, even taking the rivers that were once running wild? What would you do if they were coming for you? Liver of our mother, and it must remain in the ground. The trees are her lungs, and the rivers are her blood, and they should all be left as they were found. But now you slurry coal across these pastures, and your trees all go to feed your hungry mill. You would have us live in rows of shacks without our sheep on your church rock uranium spill. What if they were coming for your grandma? What if they were coming for your child? What if they were tearing up the ground beneath your feet, even taking the rivers that were once running wild? What would you do if they were coming for you? To knock down Ahogan's door. We will say to anyone who listen, relocation nevermore. So won't you come to Big Mountain? Bring everything you can, but come today. This is the land where we belong, and this is the land where we will stay. What if they were coming for your grandma? What if they were coming for your child? What if they were tearing up the ground beneath your feet, even taking the rivers that were once running wild? What would you do if they were coming for you? What would you do if they were coming for you? What would you do if they were coming for you?
You've been listening to Tree Sits, Lock-Ons and Barricades, a program about the history of environmental blockading in Australia, Canada and the United States during the 1980s and 1990s. At the end of that conversation with American Earth First activist Karen Coulter, you heard a live track from musician David Rovics entitled Song for Big Mountain. If you'd like to find out more about Karen's environmental campaigning work in eastern Oregon, then visit BlueMountainsBiodiversityProject.org. That's BlueMountainsBiodiversityProject.org. I'm Ian McIntyre, and I hope you'll join me on Community Radio 3CR from 11 a.m. to noon on Saturdays up until January 19th to hear more from those who took part in major environmental campaigns of decades past.